loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm John Kiriakou, and I'm joined in studio by co-host Walter Smolarek. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, a Brexit update. Next, we talk with Brian in the lead-up to the Trump-Kim summit in Hanoi. Then Indian aircraft bombed Pakistan yesterday for the first time in 50 years. And then the Cuban people approved a new constitution with 87% voting for it and 84% participation. And finally, Michael Cohen begins his testimony today before a House committee. But before we get to those stories, we'll go over today's headlines. New Jersey Senator Cory Booker secured the endorsement of Amy Nielsen, a state representative in Iowa. The endorsement of Iowa lawmakers is highly sought after by presidential contenders because of the state's early caucus vote. Nielsen was the first Iowa state legislator to endorse a presidential candidate. Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif resigned yesterday, saying, quote, "I apologize for my inability to continue serving and for all the shortcomings during my term in office. I hope my resignation will act as a spur for the foreign ministry to regain its proper statutory role in the conduct of foreign affairs," unquote. President Hassan Rouhani has not said whether he has or will accept Zarif's resignation. Zarif has favored detente with the West, while his critics have labeled the nuclear deal he negotiated as a capitulation to the country's enemies. French President Emmanuel Macron denounced yellow vest protesters today, saying, quote, "Those who join violent demonstrations are complicit with the worst. It's a miracle that after so many Saturdays marred by violence, there have been no deaths resulting from police action," unquote. But actually, 11 people have died since the protests began in November, including an 80-year-old woman who was hit with a police-fired tear gas canister. This past weekend, protests continued with another 47,000 demonstrators taking part. A U.S. appeals court today authorized wireless carrier AT&T's bid to buy massive media corporation Time Warner in an $85.4 billion merger. The argument that the Department of Justice made against the merger is that AT&T, a provider of service for Time Warner's television shows, could raise prices for other content providers, which would result in higher prices for consumers. Those are today's headlines. You're listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear.
But first, we turn to the latest developments with Brexit. British Labour Party leader Jeremy Corbyn said yesterday that the Labour Party is prepared to back another Brexit referendum if the party's own plan is rejected in Parliament tomorrow. The UK is scheduled to withdraw from the European Union on March 29th. We're joined from London by Neil Clark. He is a journalist and broadcaster whose work has appeared in The Guardian, The Week, and Morning Star. Thank you for joining, Neil.
Hi, Walter. Hi.
So this is a huge announcement. It's a big shift in the Labour Party's position. What's the significance of it?
I think it's very significant. I think that it's a very high-risk strategy from Jeremy Corbyn. The sort of context of this is really what happened, I think, last week in Labour, when we had this a number of MPs, eight MPs left the party. In fact, it became nine when Ian Austin left. And most of them, all but one, joined this so-called new independent group, which is very pro-EU and anti-Brexit. And I think what's happened is that Jeremy Corbyn was warned by his deputy leader, Tom Watson, who hasn't been arguably the most supportive of deputy leaders, to him that unless he changed, there would be further defections from the party. And I think one of the issues that Watts was keen to get change on, because he's a very strong supporter of staying in the EU, was on this whole Brexit issue. So Corbyn's come out and said that he supports having a second vote. And the significance of this, really, in terms of the Labour Party and its chances of winning the next general election, whenever that might be, what it could well be. Actually, we're being told it might be on the June the 6th, the 75th anniversary of D-Day. Well, it's high risk, to say the least. And I'll tell you why. Because out of the 64 seats that Labour's targeted to win in the next general election, that needs to win to form a government, then 45 of them are in leave voting seats, i.e. seats that voted leave in 2016, in the 2016 referendum. And a couple more stats to ponder on. The 13 key Tory-held, Conservative Party-held marginals that Labour must win, absolutely must win, to have any chance of forming the next government, were all strongly voting constituencies. In other words, 60% or more of those electors voted to leave the EU. So they're the target seats Labour's got to win. like the key states, and they're nearly all pro-leave. And on top of that, the six seats that Labour did lose in 2017, the last general election, they only lost six seats. But significantly, all six of those seats, Walter, were pro-leave.
Just to explain to our audience in the US, I mean, it's been a remarkable realignment of politics in the United Kingdom. Because, you know, going into the Brexit referendum, of course, it was called by the Conservative Party. However, the Conservative Party was split over the issue, and so was the Labour Party. You know, the European Union, the UK ascended to the EU, you know, around the time that neoliberalism was becoming the dominant trend in world politics. It's associated by many people with, you know, the deindustrialization of the economy, the decline in living standards. And so that cuts across party lines. So there's now this new group, the Independent Campaign Group, you know, eight members of the Labour Party, three members of the Conservative Party, defected to form this new sort of centrist grouping. And now, you know, what you're saying is that this shift in the position of the Labour Party in favor of a second referendum is basically a concession, if I'm understanding correctly, to that pressure by Jeremy Corbyn. Is this going to continue? Do you think that the defections will increase, or will this sort of put an end to it?
Well, I think that obviously probably Corbyn is hoping that doing this, even though he obviously knows it's very high risk for the reasons I just stated, he will be hoping that this will stem the tide of defections and that Labour can't really take any more defections. However, of course, the other big issue that these defectors made as a reason for leaving was this so-called anti-Semitism. That they allege that it's not certainly backed up by the evidence has infested the Labour Party. And we've got to be frank here that I think it was that six of the eight of the Labour MPs who left last week were all supporters of Labour Friends of Israel. They are unhappy, they have been unhappy with Corbyn from the word go, really, because he has been a veteran pro-Palestinian campaigner. He's supported Palestinian rights all his political career. So there's that issue that hasn't really been cleared up yet. And so, you know, the point of the matter is the Blairites, generally speaking, a term, you know, broad term, the Blairites, supporters of Tony Blair. I don't really think that this will be enough to placate Corbyn because they really want him out, let's be honest. So he's given in on this one, you could argue. I personally don't think that it will be enough. And I think that they're out to get him and they won't really stop until he's gone. And so I've always argued that his policy of making concessions to those who are his implacable enemies has been a mistake. And on this one, he could argue, on the European referendum point, he could argue, look, as you just said there, you know, the country is split. Yes, people voted in 2016 to leave. There might be some buyer's regret, buyer's remorse. So having a second vote might be a way out of it, but it comes in the context of having made other concessions to the Blairites too. And the problem with that is that what made Corbyn so popular in 2015 when he won the Labour Party a leadership against all the odds, and how he won again when he was challenged a year later, was his radicalism, the fact he was the anti-establishment candidate. He was taking on the elites, for the many, not the few. That was his slogan. And, you know, he has now, I'm afraid it's easy for the Tories to say, look, this guy's for the establishment. He wants to basically to stay in the EU, have another vote, keep voting again. You know, where's his anti-establishment credentials got to? That's the danger. The danger is that Corbyn, in trying to placate the Blairites, is going to lose his USP, which attracted voters to him in the first place.
John Kiriakou here. What would the modalities be of another referendum? What does the law say about having what essentially would be just a revote?
Yeah, and yes, exactly. Well, I mean, it's got to go. The key point is, we're having this conversation, but it must be said unlikely that it would get the parliamentary backing because it would have to go through, have to be voted in by Parliament, the House of Commons. Would have to vote for it. And the maths are probably not there at the moment because most Conservatives would not vote for a second referendum. So it's probably not going to happen anyway, unless, of course, Theresa May is forced to have one because she can't get through a kind of Brexit deal at all. And so we might have to have it in that case. But as you said, there's so many issues involving this. What's going to be on the ballot paper? Is it going to be a simple, is it going to be a simple repeat of the 2016? Do you want to stay in the EU or do you want to leave? And I think that would be wholly wrong because it's only 3 years since we had the last one. Some people have said that what would be fairer would be to have a high threshold for Remain. In other words, we could only have a Remain and actually stay in the EU if, say, 60%, a minimum of 60% voted to stay in. But again, you can understand how Leavers will react to that. Well, why don't we have a third referendum? Let's keep voting on. I've always been against a second vote, to be honest, because I think that we had the vote in 2016. It went on forever and ever. It seemed the campaign. I don't buy this argument that people weren't informed. We had debates all the time. We had information out and a decision was made. It wasn't a big majority, but the decision was made. And I think the mood in the country, of course, it's very split. We know that. But I think there's a general mood that just get on with this thing. I just put it to bed. And I don't think that there's a huge, even Keir Starmer, John, who is a really pro-Remain, the Labour Brexit spokesman, even he has admitted that there's no great appetite for a second referendum. So I think that this is it's actually going to cause more problems than it would solve.
We have just about a minute left. What do you think the possibility of basically Theresa May succeeding in her negotiations with European Union officials are? I mean, could this be a moot point?
Yeah, I think the key point is this, is that it hasn't been said enough that the EU arguably needs Britain more than Britain needs the EU. And what I mean by that is that the balance of trade is very much in the EU's favour. They have particularly Germany. Germany has a massive trade surplus with Britain. And German car manufacturers, German engineering industry, desperate for some sort of deal to do. So it's really like a poker game. It's really a game of bluff. And I'm fairly sure that if we didn't have a deal, say, by March the 27th, we'd have Merkel on the phone and others. It's just a question of holding one's nerve, really. And the EU, as I said, the EU needs a deal. The EU does very well out of Britain at the moment and wants that to continue. And so it would be this idea that the EU wouldn't want a deal is wrong. I think it's all about brinkmanship. And of course, not making those concessions. You know, as you know, in any concession, in any legal dispute or any business dispute, the concessions are made right at the very last minute, aren't they? And I think some people are panicking too soon about this. And I think, Britain's just really got to keep its nerve on this.
Well, we're going to leave it right there. We've been joined from London by Neil Clark. He's a journalist and broadcaster whose work has appeared in The Guardian, The Week, and Morningstar. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Walter Smolarek, filling in for Brian Becker.
President Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un arrived in Hanoi today in advance of their second bilateral summit. Substantive meetings will begin almost immediately, with the media speculating that Trump may offer to formally end the Korean War. We're joined from Hanoi by our own Brian Becker, who is there covering the summit. Welcome, Brian.
Thank you. Good to be here again.
Brian, the press here is all abuzz over the two leaders finally arriving in Hanoi. What do you expect to happen today on this first day of the summit?
Well, you know, I think the media, by the way, I'd have to say, is they are the naysayer chorus. They are so hostile. And I'm talking about the U.S. media. I bumped into a few of them here. And I have to say that they're treating the whole affair with great cynicism. You sort of get the feeling that they themselves don't want it to succeed. And they have completely bought into the neocon narrative that the real issue here is, what will North Korea do? What will North Korea specifically do to demonstrate its willingness to give up its nuclear weapons? Meanwhile, of course, the United States has thousands, literally thousands of nuclear weapons, some of them on submarines, some of them on airplanes, some of them on land-based missiles. And, you know, you would never know that from the media. It's as if the great North Korean military is on the march, and what will this summit do? And then, of course, the answer that they give to themselves is not much, that it'll be banal platitudes and generalities. Well, maybe so, but I think that your question points us in the right direction. Donald Trump and Kim Jong-un, by having a second summit, actually sustain the momentum that was initiated at the first summit. And if the two leaders did not meet again, there would be so much in terms of headwinds in Washington against a nuclear deal or a new arrangement with North Korea of some type, that the thing would just die on its own volition. So I think the most important thing is a reaffirmation in the face of these headwinds of both the letter and the spirit of the Singapore summit agreement that was signed June 12th of last year. What does that summit agreement say? It says, number one, that the U.S. and North Korea pledge to improve relations. Number two, that the two countries will establish a peace mechanism on the Korean Peninsula. It's only point number three when it talks about denuclearization and a pledge by both sides to denuclearize the Korean Peninsula. So I think the real issue here is now that North Korea has unilaterally declared a moratorium on nuclear weapons tests, unilaterally declared a moratorium on ballistic missile technology tests, what will the United States do? Simply not having one war exercise or two exercises isn't much. The U.S. imposes heavy sanctions on the DPRK. The United States still threatens the DPRK by virtue of its military presence in the Pacific region. So I think what needs to happen at the summit and what may happen is that there could be some additional definition to what denuclearization means, not the banal media assumption that denuclearization means that North Korea disarm itself even before the country is technically at peace with its adversary, but rather that both sides come up with mutually agreed upon reciprocal steps whereby they climb down or off of the escalation ladder, then further up it.
What are North Korea's goals for this summit? I mean, the U.S. side has made it very clear that they want the DPRK to give up its nuclear capabilities. But what are Kim Jong-un's goals going into this summit?
Well, I think Kim Jong-un really comes into the summit in a fairly strong position. The DPRK has improved its relations with South Korea. It's improved its relations with China. It's clearly, it's having this summit here in Hanoi have better relations with Vietnam. I think what the North Koreans would like to have happen is enough momentum going forward so that it doesn't turn out as it did in the early 2000s, where any sort of forward motion towards peace is basically destroyed by some other political force in Washington. So, you know, the North Koreans remember that Bill Clinton almost normalized relations with the DPRK in the year 2000, in his last year. And then the U.S. had a new government, George W. Bush, and he torpedoed it, sabotaged it. And the North Koreans are well aware Donald Trump could not be president in 18 months. What they'd like to do is cement enough progress going forward in terms of the improvement of relations that it's not that easily undone once again. So I think the goals of North Korea are fairly limited. One is to keep the momentum going, keep the dialogue going. They've offered something which is palpable, which is they've stopped doing nuclear weapons tests. They have stopped improving their nuclear weapons capabilities. And likewise with ballistic missiles, the missiles that they've tested have a long range capability, but the North Korean ICBMs haven't yet proved to be able to also deliver nuclear warheads with those missiles. So the North Koreans not testing, doing additional ballistic missile testing is really a significant concession to the United States. So Kim Jong-un will want to see, can Donald Trump, in the face of headwinds in Washington from the Republicans, the Democrats, and the Pentagon, I would say, in the military-industrial complex, does Donald Trump still have enough authority to keep going forward? And if they could come out of this with a, even if it's symbolic, a declaration that the Korean War has ended, I think they will feel that they've achieved their primary goal.
Brian, the press today here in the States is all abuzz over the word denuclearization, that the ultimate goal of the United States here is what they're calling the complete denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula. What exactly does that mean? And is that a realistic hope either in this summit or at some future summit?
I don't think so in one sense. I mean, the U.S. has nuclear weapons on Trident submarines, and they prowl around the Pacific area, right around the Korean Peninsula. The U.S. has intercontinental ballistic missiles pointed in the direction of Korea and China and Russia. The U.S. has B-1, B-2, and B-52 bombers always at the ready and capable of carrying nuclear weapons to the Korean Peninsula. So if you think about comprehensive denuclearization, that means the U.S. too, right? It doesn't just mean one side disarming, like North Korea disarming. So what does it really mean? I mean, when the U.S. uses denuclearization as basically this, quote, litmus test for North Korea's sincerity, But the U.S. is a signatory to something called the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. It signed it in 1969. And that treaty required the signers, those who possess nuclear weapons, it gave them an affirmative obligation that they must get rid of their nuclear weapons as a quid pro quo for the non-nuclear powers not acquiring nuclear weapons. Now, let's ask ourselves, each and every one of us, to be honest, is the U.S. on the pledge of meeting its a commitment to denuclearize itself? And the answer to that would have to be an absolute no.
Yeah, it's a resounding no.
It's a resounding no, because right now Trump is modernizing and the Pentagon is modernizing, and so did Obama, modernizing, not getting rid of their nuclear weapons. So it's kind of like if we take the measure of denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula to simply mean what will North Korea do to prove that it's an absolute weak, vulnerable power in the face of this nuclear threat from a country that earlier annihilated it, literally, between 1950 and 53, I think it kind of buys into the media propaganda, government propaganda, anti-peace propaganda, and we don't really learn what is possible. What is possible is North Korea could cap its nuclear weapons, it could stop more nuclear weapons tests, it could roll back some of its nuclear weapons, maybe it would get rid of all of them. The only countries to have done that so far was South Africa. After the majority black government came in, they got rid of their nuclear weapons. And Ukraine, which was part of the Soviet Union after the dissolution of the Soviet Union, Ukraine no longer was in possession of nuclear weapons. No other country has gotten rid of nuclear weapons once it had it. But I think it's realistic to cap North Korea's nuclear weapons program in exchange for an end to economic sanctions.
Brian, what's the importance of Vietnam as a venue for the summit?
It can't be lost on anyone that Vietnam was the war after the Korean War that the United States fought. 58,000 Americans died here. Millions of Vietnamese died during that war. And yet, here we are 36 years after the Nixon administration carried out what was called the Christmas bombing of Hanoi, where I am. This city was heavily destroyed by U.S. bombers. But 36 years later, Vietnam and the United States are not only not enemies, they have very good relations. They have a lot of commerce and trade. They have good diplomatic relations. And I think the point of it is that if the United States can have a detente, a rapprochement, peace with Vietnam, why can't they do the same with the DPRK?
That's right.
And of course, that makes perfect sense.
Well, we will leave it there. We were joined from Hanoi by our colleague Brian Becker, who is there covering the summit. He will talk with us again tomorrow and give us the latest news. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou, joined in studio with my co-host, Walter Smolarek. For the first time in a half century, Indian fighter jets this morning carried out airstrikes inside Pakistan, killing what the Indians called, quote, a very large number of Jaish-e-Mohammed terrorists, unquote. The strikes come in response to a suicide bombing last week that killed 40 Indian soldiers in the disputed region of Kashmir. We're joined from Washington by Dr. Marvin Weinbaum. He's the scholar in residence and director of the Middle East Institute's Center for Pakistan and Afghanistan Studies. Welcome back, Marvin.
Thank you.
Marvin, the first time in a half a century that fighter jets bombed Pakistani territory.
Well, yes and no.
Ah, tell us.
Because there was an attack last year in which they claimed that they were attacking. It was not, I believe, an air attack. It was probably an artillery attack, but it bears resemblance to this in that the Indians claim that they were able to bring significant damage to a terrorist operation, and the Pakistanis on that occasion simply denied it ever took place. So here we have an attack in which very much in the same way, India says was very effective. Apparently there were three different, not one target, but three different targets that they hit last evening. And that Pakistan has said, well, no, you just bombed open fields. Nobody was killed. So it bears strong resemblance. And the important point in both cases is that the two countries could save face. they could placate their publics, which, you know, are very much nationalistic. One could say there was retribution, and the other could say no. Either there was nothing at all, or it was very minimal. And if that's the case, this is the best of all possible outcomes. We've been sitting here and everywhere else worrying that the Indians were going to mount the kind of military response that would force Pakistan into something of significant proportion. But what we have here is, if the Pakistanis respond at all, it's likely to be just a token response, because after all, there was nothing great that happened. So I see this with a degree of relief, assuming now that I'm not wrong here, and that Pakistan does sort of let sleeping dogs lie.
Well, do you think then that we shouldn't expect to see Pakistani retaliation?
Well, what I'm saying is that there's no need for any significant retaliation, because there, by Pakistan's propaganda at least, or statements, nothing serious really took place. So I'm saying that it may very well be a token response. If, however, Pakistan were to say that there were, as they might have, those weren't terrorists, those were civilians that you killed, that would have been very difficult, very different situation.
You and I both have been to both Pakistan and India many times, I'm sure, and they both have very, very closely held feelings about Kashmir. Can you tell us a little bit about the situation in Kashmir and whether there's any realistic chance of a settlement one way or the other?
Well, the situation has become quite dire. There has been an upsurge in violence in Kashmir. It's been occupied by 350,000 or so Indian troops. So this is, there's a soldier at every corner here. They have been effectively had Kashmir in a state of siege for some time. There is sporadic violence. And then you have something like this attack that's just taken place, and in which 40 military personnel were killed in a car bomb, which was a young man suicide bombing, who apparently had an affiliation with this Pakistani jihadi group called Jaish-e Mohammed. And Jaish-e Mohammed took credit for the attack. The Indians came back and said, well, the Pakistani intelligence, as in the case of Bombay more than 10 years ago, in that attack, there was clear evidence here that the intelligence services of the Pakistan Army was involved, and that's what happened in this case, and therefore we hold Pakistan responsible. But they didn't, in their attack yesterday, they didn't attack Pakistani military units. Again, they singled out these so-called terrorist camps. And we do know that some remain. What we think is that what the Pakistanis have, because they claim that they closed all of those down, is that those camps as launching sites for infiltration into Kashmir have been suspended, but that the training actually still goes on. So it's a dispute which has been, there since 1947 in the founding of Pakistan. It's one which has never really, in any sense, been resolved, because it pits two very basic foundation beliefs on both sides. One, that it should be part of Pakistan because it has a majority population of Muslims, although there's a sizable portion who are Hindu, but it should be part of Pakistan because that was the formula in which Pakistan was created, that those Muslim states in the old Indian Raj would be part of this new state of Pakistan. They would accede to, all states had to accede to either Pakistan or India, and that would be the basis upon which they would separate out. And because Pakistan defines itself as a Islamic state, therefore it claims that it should, you know, have rule over the Muslims as was intended. India, however, never defined itself as a religious state, but as a secular state. And so it said there's no reason to give it, because Muslims and Hindus can live perfectly okay together. After all, India has, I don't know the exact figure, but it's probably around 175 million Muslims, a sizable portion of the population, although it's a 1.2 billion population, nevertheless. And they're there, and many Muslims hold positions of considerable responsibility, although as a group, they do less well off. So that it pits, again, two very different concepts of what the nation state is. In one case, it's built on the idea of Islamic adherence, and that you have to be a Muslim to hold office in Pakistan, for example. Whereas in India, in theory, anyone can hold office, and there have been Christians as well in positions of considerable authority in India, as well as Muslims.
The Council on Foreign Relations wrote today that this is a policy change, this retaliation is a policy change for India, that over the past few decades, the Indian government has chosen not to retaliate after terror attacks in Kashmir, but lately they've changed that and they have been retaliating. Do you think that that's a permanent situation?
Well, I don't think that's true at all, because in 1999, the Pakistanis penetrated in this Kargil area, a high mountainous area, penetrated into India's territory and was in a position where it could even cut off a major highway. It was an effort here to draw public attention to Kashmir, I should say international attention to Kashmir. So it, without any thought about what India might do, well, India responded with its own military offensive. Both countries really clashed, mostly though the deaths were from plane attacks and artillery. But no, there was a response here. And as I said, there was not too long ago, there was an attack as well on the military. I guess it's probably a couple of years ago now. And the Indians claim that they had destroyed these camps. And as I think I mentioned earlier, Pakistan denied that an attack had ever taken place. Well, apparently it had. But again, it was so minor a attack that Pakistan could get away with saying that nothing happened. In this case, they couldn't do that. It was clear that there had been planes that had violated the sovereignty of Pakistan's airspace. So they couldn't do it this time, but they could. What they did do was to minimize again that it was anything significant.
Indeed. Well, that was the voice of Dr. Marvin Weinbaum. He's a scholar in residence and director of the Middle East Institute's Center for Pakistan and Afghanistan Studies. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll be back after a short message.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Walter Smolarek, filling in for Brian Becker.
Cubans yesterday overwhelmingly ratified a new constitution that replaces the country's 1976 charter. 84.4% of Cuba's 8.7 million voters went to the polls, with 87% supporting ratification, 9% opposing it, and the remainder entering spoiled or blank ballots. We're joined from Montreal by Arnold August. He's a lecturer, journalist, and author of the book Cuba-U.S. Relations, Obama and Beyond. Welcome back, Arnold.
It's a pleasure to be with you once again.
Arnold, we're happy to have you. Can you explain to us the import of this new constitution? Why did the constitution in Cuba need to be rewritten or updated?
There are several reasons, but I would say the main reason is, on the one hand, Cuba, as everyone knows, is quite well publicized, that Cuba has been making important changes to its economic system, whereby the state has become increasingly decentralized and opening up certain sections of the economy, such as small enterprises, barbershops, restaurants, beauty parlors, etc., so that instead of the state having that onerous responsibility of trying to manage these very small enterprises, these have been given into the hands of local enterprisers, local entrepreneurs who are willing to work out small local private businesses. And this has been developing over the years, several years now, to the extent that well over 550,000 people are involved in one way or another in these private enterprises. Of course, what the Constitution did was to finally give a legal constitutional basis for this section of the Cuban society, a constitutional basis which did not exist before yesterday's approval of the Constitution. There are very other things as well. There was a lot of discussion whether Cuba should, to what extent Cuba should carry on toward the socialist path. And on that point, of course, it was indicated that while people have the right to open up their own small private enterprises, or what people would say is a market economy, even though that's not the correct word, it also, the Constitution also clearly spelled out, and this was even further established and insisted upon by the people in the Mascarutes meetings, that the economy remains a socialist economy where the main instruments of production, as well as, of course, health, education, military, all this remains in the hands of the state. Now, even then, going back to the small enterprises, the small new market type of economy, it has to be mentioned, something that is not often said, that while they are allowed to and are encouraged now to develop their small enterprises, one has to look at it at a different point of view, the point of view of Cuba's new socialism. That is, people who open up a new enterprise, they have to purchase a license. They have to pay taxes to the state on their sales. They also have to pay sort of a tax or a surcharge on the people that they hire to work in their respective businesses. But the important thing here to realize, John, is that all of this money is funneled back, unlike what we know in the capitalist countries, it's funneled back into the economy specifically to further shore up, improve, and develop the education system, the health system, cultural, sports, and other endeavors, which are basically free of charge and are flourishing in Cuba. One of the reasons being that they have this increased income from the small businesses. So all of these things are enshrined in the new constitution. I think what is important in my point of view, if you want me to carry on in that same vein, looking at from the point of view of the North, say as a Canadian, or you have had the same impression living in the United States, when the initial draft was deposited, was tabled in the parliament, back, I believe, in July of last year, the term communism was deleted for the first time in the history of Cuban constitution since 1976. It was just deleted. Now, this created a huge backlash. Contrary to what the mainstream media would have thought, oh, now the Cubans are going to be happy. They're not saddled with this ideal of communism. But what happened was that actually the opposite. The media, of course, were happy to report, Cuba has dropped communism. They're opening up the society to private enterprise, which is not exactly as they describe it, given to, you know, based on what I just mentioned in terms of the taxes and funneling back funds from private enterprise into the economy, but they were happy, elated. Cuba has given up communism. Now, when this constitution went back to the people, and I was there for 2 weeks during the 3 months period last summer and fall, when people were discussing on a grassroots basis, that is, places of work, universities, neighborhoods, all over the place. There was wide open discussion, open-ended discussion on the Constitution. As well, I would mention amongst our colleagues in Cuba, the journalists were very active on this front, and the basic consensus that came out on that issue of term communism, which is more than just a term, it's a whole conception, it's a whole like a value set of what a society is based on, they say, no, we do not want to delete the word communism from our constitution. That this gives the impression that we've given up on this ideal, even though they admit it is a very long-term ideal, difficult to attain, but this is our ideal. Now, coming from the North, as I mentioned, I thought that was a very important point. Because if you have just Cuba is for socialism, this leads one to believe, oh, it's just another social democratic state. And as we know, unfortunately, social democrats or socialists that are really democrats, they are dime a dozen in the United States and Canada. It's in fact the trend now. People are calling themselves socialist democrats, but their basic policy is not different than the Democratic Party, and it's surely not different than the Republican Party. If you take just the example of Venezuela, or even the most leftist, such as AOC, such as Bernie Sanders, refuse to recognize the Maduro government and refuse to oppose all U.S. intervention in Venezuela. Just giving one example. So the Cuban people from the grassroots made sure that there was no notion abounding in Cuba or in the world that Cuba is just another social democratic country. It's a socialist country, a socialist system with its problems, but always with the ideal of reaching the communist ideals. And they made sure that the names of Marx, Engels, and Lenin, along with Fidel and José Martí, were enshrined in the Constitution to act as the guiding lights, if you like, for how people think and act in that country.
If I could just jump in here for a moment. We have about 3 minutes left. I want to ask you about the system that led to the ratification of this new constitution, because the way the coverage of it in the corporate media, and especially in the United States, is it's designed to make people think, oh, this was a fake vote, right? You know, there are no elections where 87% of people vote in one direction. But elections work differently in Cuba because it's really the sort of conclusion of a long and participatory process. Can you talk about how this constitution was debated, discussed, amended, and then, you know, finally now voted upon?
Yes. Okay, I'll try to sum that up in 2 minutes to respect our time limit. When the constitution was presented to the people all over the country, different workplaces, etc., I was there at the time, and the atmosphere in Cuba was the exact opposite of what is portrayed in these media that you were referring to. The media always give the impression, oh, Cuba, it's a great society. People are afraid to talk. It's hush-hush. People are afraid to give their open opinions. What happened in Cuba during that 3 months period, in my view, based on my own experience and speaking with my colleagues in Cuba, there has never been such a lively, open debate on the future of Cuban society in the context of discussing the new constitution. And when the vote actually took place, you have 87% of the people participating in that vote. Now, I noticed in some newspapers, they are trying to belittle this voter turnout of 87%, saying, oh, it is not as much as 97% when the first constitution was voted upon way back in 1976. But this is ridiculous. One cannot compare 1976 situation when Cuba was doing very well, had close ties to the Soviet Union, there were no major economic problems, to a current situation whereby the special period and the increased effects of the blockade have very serious effects on the Cuban people. And this is reflected in the voter turnout, which in fact has been going down for several years.
That's exactly what CNN did this morning, where they said, oh, well, this turnout was only 87%. It was far below the 1976 vote. And that shows the weakening of support for the Cuban government, which I thought was kind of ridiculous. I'm sorry to say we're out of time, though. We were joined from Montreal by Arnold August. Arnold is a lecturer, journalist, and author of the excellent book, Cuba-U.S. Relations, Obama and Beyond. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay tuned. We'll be back after a short break.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Walter Smolarek, filling in for Brian Becker.
President Trump's former attorney, Michael Cohen, is scheduled to begin 3 days of testimony on Capitol Hill today. Two of those sessions will be behind closed doors, in closed session. The third is in open session. The mainstream media says that Cohen will likely tell lawmakers about illegalities the president, his company, and maybe even his children may have been involved in. We're joined from New York by Daniel Lazar. He's a journalist and the author of three books, The Frozen Republic, The Velvet Coup, and America's Undeclared War. Welcome back, Daniel.
Thanks for having me.
Daniel, of course, we're speculating here because this is a closed session. Nothing has leaked out so far. But the press is just salivating over the notion that Michael Cohen is spilling the beans on illegalities that the Trumps, the Trump administration, the Trump companies have been engaged in. What do you think this is all about?
What it's all about is about Russia, in a single word. I mean, this is all this whole affair is just, I mean, I've been more and more struck by how much it really is a foreign policy dispute in disguise. I mean, essentially, the establishment was taken aback when Trump refused to toe the line in attacking Russia back in 2016, vowed their revenge, and was horrified when Trump was then elected president and went into full war mode to block him from seeking any kind of rapprochement with Russia, deal on Syria, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So there's a vicious civil war going on in Washington. It's highly circuitous. It involves accusations of criminal conduct, a major legal investigation, et cetera, et cetera. But really, when it all comes down to, it's a foreign policy dispute involving Russia and allied issues.
Daniel, you're in New York City. Is it shocking to you that a New York City real estate mogul may have committed crimes?
Well, yeah. I mean, Trump is a mess. He's a freewheeler. He's had numerous ups and downs in his career. He's flirted with bankruptcy. He's known in the trade as a goneth, a thief, somebody doesn't pay his contractors. So the guy's reputation is not very good. He's a showman. So yeah, so it's entirely possible. I mean, entirely possible. It's extremely likely that he has engaged in dishonest practices and illegal activities. But again, this is not what this is about primarily. This is about a civil war over U.S. foreign policy, U.S. foreign policy failures, vengeance on the part of the neocon establishment, and a struggle over the future direction of U.S. imperial policies.
And then in the end, what exactly do the Democrats hope to accomplish? It's not like this is a law enforcement issue for them, for Democrats. Is this just to embarrass the president? And if it is just to embarrass the president, why have these sessions closed to the public?
I'm not really sure why this hearings are closed to the public. But it's about an attempt to embarrass Trump, to cripple Trump, to maybe even pave the way for impeachment if they somehow come up with something good, and then to prepare the way for the 2020 campaign, when they hopefully will be able to dispatch a weakened Trump with relative ease.
Well, let's talk about Michael Cohen's calculations here. I mean, a number of people have been indicted as part of the Mueller investigation into Donald Trump. There's sort of two directions that you can go. I mean, people like Paul Manafort, I think, are angling for a pardon, right? They're sort of presenting themselves as this martyr for the Trump cause. Michael Cohen is going in a very different direction. What do you think his plan is?
I'm not really sure here, actually. I'm not really sure what he's up to in this case, unless maybe it's to write a book when he gets out of prison, then earn himself, you know, many millions of dollars. But I'm not really quite sure what his motivation is. But he's obviously not hoping for a pardon from Trump, because Trump will never grant him that at this point.
Right, right. I mean, you know, Cohen, of course, has now turned on his former boss. He's denounced him. He's going to, today, right, he's probably telling senators behind closed door, members of Congress behind closed doors, that, you know, Donald Trump did all these horrible things, which, you know, very well could be true. And then we'll And then we'll publicly embarrass him, right, later on in the week. I mean, do you think that there's any hope? Like, if this is a maneuver to win the sympathy of Democrats or Republicans who are opponents of Donald Trump, do you think there's any chance of that succeeding?
There's a chance that's succeeding, but to what end? I mean, he's going to prison. That seems to be pretty sure. That seems to be unavoidable. So what can the Democrats do for him at this point, except maybe buy his book 12 months from now?
That's so true. You know, I understand politics. I've done two stints on Capitol Hill, one on the House side, one on the Senate side. I get how it works, but I just don't understand what's in it for Cohen right now.
I don't see what it is actually either, except, as I said, maybe a book deal down the road. But the thing is that Trump, I mean, he's going to prison at this point. That seems to be unavoidable. So I'm not really sure what he hopes to gain by these appearances.
Yeah, and he also committed, I mean, his behavior leading up to this was kind of bizarre. I mean, he asked for the hearings to be postponed. You know, he said he was just in too much pain, but then he was seen and photographed, you know, going out for dinner at a fancy restaurant. That wasn't helpful, right, to his cause, his attempt to present himself as sort of the sympathetic figure. I mean, let's talk about who Michael Cohen is, right? Because, you know, his narrative is that, well, you know, I was just too loyal to Donald Trump. You know, he was my employer. I was a loyal employee, and it simply got me in trouble. But I have to stop being loyal now and speak the truth. How do you react to that?
I react with extreme skepticism. Cohen's a guy who admired Trump. He worshipped him from college on. Apparently, he was transformed when he read The Art of the Deal. You know, somebody who worships the shrine of Donald Trump is immediately morally suspect. So I don't think that anything that Cohen says should be taken at face value. The guy is duplicitous in the extreme.
Let's talk about sort of the bigger picture of how these types of investigations work. I mean, the Mueller probe, so Michael Cohen is one of the people who have gotten caught up into it. There's been many, many, many other people who have also been indicted. They don't really have anything to do with Russia. I mean, the only people who have been indicted for things related to Russia, I believe, are actually like Russians themselves who are in Russia and obviously right. cannot be brought before the U.S. justice system. So we've been talking about what Michael Cohen's calculations are. What do you think Mueller is trying to do here? What's his strategy in terms of the investigation, which appears to be wrapping up now, but, you know, by putting or by charging people with, you know, pretty serious crimes unrelated to the core of the investigation. Right. Where's he going with that?
Yeah, I mean, I don't really know. I think he's still trying to apply the screws to Manafort and to try to somehow get him to confess to some kind of collusion. But that just seems to be extremely unlikely. And I must say, I mean, Mueller is so bad that he's making me feel sympathy for poor Paul Manafort, who is like being held in prison. He's placed under duress in order to make him crack when it comes to revelations about collusion with Russia. But I just don't think there's anything to it. I've said this before 1,000 times. There was no collusion. I don't think there's anything that Manafort has that can he can tell Mueller in this regard. But Mueller is, you know, just twisting the thumb screws, tightening the thumb screws in order to somehow get Manafort to talk. I think Mueller has come up totally dry on the collusion question.
I have to agree. I think that there has been literally no evidence of collusion. What we've seen so far is a whole host of process felonies, and we've said this a million times on this show, obstruction of justice, making a false statement, impeding a government proceeding, silly things that have nothing whatsoever to do with collusion. I agree also that the investigation is wrapping up. We know that because several of the lead investigators and at least two attorneys last week resigned to go back into private practice. And so there are fewer and fewer staff members actually working on this case. And I think that as far as as Cohen's testimony goes on Capitol Hill, he's already been sentenced. He has nothing to gain. And so I think he's doing it just to take one final slap at Donald Trump.
We're talking with Daniel Lazar. He's a journalist and author of three books, The Frozen Republic, The Velvet Coup, and America's Undeclared War. Daniel, go ahead.
I mean, I really believe that his ultimate goal is to build up publicity for his forthcoming book. But I must say there has been collusion. We have plenty of evidence of collusion, only it's not between the Trump campaign and Russia. It's between and among numerous intelligence agencies on both sides of the Atlantic in order to somehow tar Trump with his Russian associations. And this is not just paranoia. The pattern is really quite clear. This whole hysteria was drummed up by MI6, the CIA, the Democratic National Committee, etc. They have created a furor over the collusion question without presenting anything by way of strong evidence. So that manufactured campaign nearly culminated in a coup d'etat.
Exactly what it seems, at least in process. We're going to have to leave it there, Daniel. We were joined from New York by Daniel Lazar. He is a journalist and the author of three books, The Frozen Republic, The Velvet Coup, and America's Undeclared War. You've been listening to Loud and Clear. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. And you can follow us on Twitter at Loud Clear Radio. You can hear us every day, Monday through Friday, from 4 to 6 p.m. on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area. You can also hear us at SputnikNews.com and as a podcast at iTunes, iHeartRadio, Spreaker, and Spotify. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. Stay tuned to Radio Sputnik.
Loud and clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, Community Public Radio. I'm your host, Don DeBar.